WPR is committed to a diverse schedule of news, music, talk, and entertainment programs. Member support is the single biggest piece of our funding. It makes all the WPR programs you enjoy possible. Donate today at WPR.org.
Do you hate the news media? Or maybe just select journalistic outlets? How did the news media go from one of the most respected institutions in the U.S. just a few decades ago to one of the most reviled today? Our guest examines that question and the result of that disrespect in his book, Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, February the 17th. We will welcome your questions and maybe your answers for our guest. Do you hate the media or distrust it anyway? If so, how do you get your political information? How do you decide who you're going to vote for? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest says that our lack of confidence in our news media has altered the way that we acquire our political information and form our voting preferences. He is Jonathan Ladd, Assistant Professor of Government and Public Policy at Georgetown University, author of Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Thanks a lot for joining us. So, I'm trying to remember back in the 1970s. People respected the news media then?
Yes, the polling evidence was pretty strong at that point, in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. So one of the more famous polls was one from 1972 that asked people's trust in various public figures, including their senator, the president, President Nixon at the time, the vice president, their member of Congress, et cetera. And they also included Walter Cronkite, who at that point was the anchor of the CBS Evening News. And, of course, Walter Cronkite was trusted by more of the population than any other figure in that poll, 72% of the. So, I mean, that poll ended up getting a lot of publicity, and I think Walter Cronkite even titled his autobiography The Most Trusted Man in America, so he sort of embraced it, too. As you look at academic surveys that have asked the same questions over time, you can see this trend. So at the same time, in 1973, the General Social Survey, which is a big survey funded by the National Science Foundation, conducted by sociologists, it asked people how much confidence they had in the press, and only about 15% of the population said they had hardly any confidence in the press. By the late 2000s, by the 2008 General Social Survey, asking the same question, surveying in the same way, 45%, you know, almost half of people said they had hardly any confidence in the press. And you see similar trends in a lot of other polls. One of my favorite polls is one from a few years ago, from 2004, but about the time we'd reached the nadir of confidence in the press already that we're still in. It asked people's confidence in a number of professions that included lawyers, about 9% of Americans had a great deal of confidence in lawyers, and 10% of people had a great deal of confidence in the national news media. So about the same number of people have confidence in national news media as has confidence in lawyers.
I seem to remember one, too, that had used car salesmen and journalists on the same, you know, level of distrust.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. That's very consistent with all the other ones I've looked at, yeah.
You know, it is very fascinating to me as someone who's in the news media. What was it about the 50s, 60s, and early 70s that caused people to really respect the news media?
Well, one thing I try to point out in the book is that I don't think it's that journalists were better people in the 60s and 70s, or that it's just something inherent. I mean, human nature is what it is, and doesn't change that much over time. Journalists many journalists, both then and now, try to do their best to cover the news accurately. I think what's underappreciated are the big structural factors that have changed in two ways. First, the structure of politics has changed a lot, and the structure of the news industry has changed a lot. Well, and those have made a big difference.
Yeah, so how has the structure of the news media made a difference?
Well, first, in the news media, that structure of that has changed because there's a lot more competition. And there's a lot more, and the media environment is a lot more diverse, right? And so in the 50s and 60s, most cities had one newspaper, and that's still true. But in addition to that, you had only two or sometimes three major network stations where you could get their news with good reception on your television. And you didn't have cable news options. You didn't have a very active political talk radio or really popular, even regular news radio stations. And, of course, you didn't have these news sources on the Internet. And what that's done is that the advent of this competition, it provides a number of sources that are going to provide news in a different style. Right, in some of them in a style that's more partisan, and the partisan news, while some people like it, but turns other people off, the partisan news outlets also spend a good deal of their time criticizing the press itself or other news outlets. So there was one study done just as a representative example, because it's so popular, over the Rush Limbaugh program, and found that depending on the day you examine it, the number one or the number two most popular issue discussed on that program, called issue area, is criticism of the press, right? And that's very characteristic of partisan news outlets, whether they're on the Internet or on the radio. And so these partisan news outlets criticize the press a lot. And I found in some experiments that if a partisan opinion leader criticizes the press, that actually changes your opinion of the press a good amount. And if some of the press is reporting things in a more sensationalist and covering tabloid stories, that actually gets ratings. People like to tune into that, but it doesn't necessarily increase trust. Actually, mm-hmm. People view the press as a less trusted source, even though it gets ratings. So this competition for ratings, and that drives for more sensationalist coverage, as well as the movement into more ideological niches, both of these have the consequence of, while people like to tune into these different styles of news, they have the consequence of decreasing people's trust in the institutional or conventional news industry.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you had mentioned that changes in the structure of the news industry led to this downfall in trust, but also changes in the political system. What did you mean there?
Right. Well, at the same time that since the mid-20th century, the news industry has become more fragmented, the political system has been getting more polarized by party. So that's just a different way of saying that the parties disagree a lot about what policy they would prefer, a lot more than they did in the 50s and 60s. And you can track this a number of ways. I mean, you can track this just by following the news and getting your own impression of the positions of the two parties and how far apart they are. You can also track this in a number of other quantitative ways, like political scientists who analyze roll call votes in Congress to tally up and track exactly what the ideology of each member of Congress is, find that members of Congress in their voting records, the two parties are much further apart than they were in the 50s and 60s. So the parties disagree a lot more. The consequence of that is the stakes in elections are higher, and political leaders have more of an incentive to try to criticize and bring in disrepute sources of information that may disagree with them. So they both attack sources of information that they view and try to discredit them, that they view as hostile. So, you know, partisan news outlets of the other side, as well as news sources that aren't necessarily hostile to them, but maybe unpredictable in the future, like news outlets that are trying to be independent. News outlets, so they're have an incentive to criticize them in that way. And on top of that, right, people just, when you need a more polarized political system, the parties just don't agree on the basic facts. They have disagreements not just about opinions, but about facts. And as a result, people just won't be as satisfied with what is reported because there's really no common facts and common way to describe reality that everyone will be satisfied with when people in the political system disagree so much.
Our guest is Jonathan Ladd, Assistant Professor of Government and Public Policy at Georgetown University and author of Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in. Our lines are full at the moment, but you can get in once someone hangs up. And you can also email us, talk@WPR.org. There's also a place to post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Turning mostly cloudy today, a chance of snow in northern Wisconsin with rain expected in the south, with highs in the upper 30s in the north to the low 40s in the south. It's going to be mostly sunny this weekend with highs in the 20s and 30s on Saturday and in the 30s on Sunday. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. It's 20 minutes past 7 o'clock now on this Friday, February the 17th, and after 8 o'clock this morning, it's our regular Friday Week in Review. We'll have two guests from different political perspectives talking about all the big state, national, and international news stories of the week. That's coming up, our Week in Review, after 8. Right now, we're talking about why we hate the media, or why we don't trust it anyway. Our guest is the author of Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters, Jonathan Ladd, an assistant professor of government and public policy at Georgetown University. We do have full lines, and I do want to get to our callers in just a moment, Professor Ladd, but we talked some about why we hate the media. Now, why does this matter?
Well, it matters because I found some evidence that people learn differently when they distrust institutional press than when they don't. And they learn basic facts differently. So we mentioned how in the more polarized political system, people disagree not just about opinions, but about facts. And you can see this in the public. So political scientists have documented for a long time that the parties sometimes disagree about facts. For example, when George W. Bush was president and you asked people, not their opinion about George W. Bush, but you asked them just how things were going in the country. You asked, how has the economy been doing in the last few years? And when Bush was president, Republicans thought the economy was doing relatively better than Democrats did. And you asked them about other things like the deficit, how has it been going? Republicans thought things were going relatively better than the Democrats did. You ask with foreign affairs, you get a similar thing. In general, perceptions of facts, perceptions of how things are going, Republicans thought things were going better than Democrats did. Interestingly, if you went back to polls done when Clinton was president, Democrats thought the economy was relatively better than Republicans did. Ask about how safe are we from foreign enemies, foreign policy. Again, Democrats thought things were going better than Republicans did. So you have these differences in the public in perceptions, not their opinions of the president and whether they should be credited or not, but actual perceptions of facts. These partisan differences in facts are more extreme among people who distrust the press. And what tends to happen is that people who distrust the press are more, they're more resistant to new information that they encounter in the world, and as a result, they fall back on their prior perceptions and prior beliefs, and oftentimes, in the absence of information, fall back on their partisanship to form their beliefs and just rely on their partisanship as sort of a cue, as a shortcut to form their beliefs. And the consequence of this is that they end up voting in a more partisan way. So, and so this does have an important consequence. And now we shouldn't be—I don't want to be overly alarmist because there are, you know, worse consequences in the world than voting in a partisan way. But we want to think about that, the fact that decreasing trust in some sort of common information source is one source of more polarized partisan voting among the public. And to the extent that that's a problem, then this could be a problem.
Let's take some calls. Mike in Heartland is with us. Hello, Mike.
Hi. How are you doing tonight?
Or it is this morning, I mean. Sorry.
Doing well.
So good. Just a quick comment. I agree with your guest a lot with his comments. The one thing I'd say, I think, is I agree everything's more polarized now than it used to be. I also think that generally people were more ignorant in the past because there were fewer media sources. So if they all run the same story in the exact same angle, it didn't really matter. That's what people took as the truth, although in reality, you know, everything's spun a little bit and everybody's got bias, no matter how unbiased they say they are. But ultimately, I think the advent of the Internet as a source of information is huge, and that helps people actually just see the facts and not see the spin on the facts from whatever media outlet wants to turn them whatever way or only report part of the facts. And then I also think there's three groups of people. He talked about the polarization, Democrats, Republicans, as far as the political aspect. I think there's a huge group of people in the middle, independents and moderates, who, you know, I consider myself, where I just try to look at the facts and pick the best candidate, the example of the presidential candidate. And it seems so polarized one side or another, the way the facts are presented, it's so biased either way that it's hard to look at those typical media outlets, and you have to find the information on your own. And a good example would be the way that presidential candidate, you know, Ron Paul is covered, where he's just not covered fairly in the media.
Yeah, I knew that was coming, Mike. So how do you decide what are the facts, Mike?
Well, that's what I said. What I end up doing is I look at I look at MSNBC one day, I'll look at Fox the next day, I'll look at the BBC and the way that they interpret the facts. I look at, you know, Reuters, looking at foreign press sometimes, how they interpret things, I think, is, which is, again, with the Internet, is much easier to do nowadays, even Al Jazeera, you know, to see how they interpret things versus how the West interprets things occurring in the Middle East is entirely different sometimes. But that's what's presented to us, and I think there's less ignorance nowadays, so there's a huge group of people that they have that capability with the Internet to really interpret things, and then here's the actual information, and I'm going to interpret the information myself versus I'm going to have somebody either on the Internet or via the main, if you want to call it the mainstream media or whatever, the cable and the broadcast networks, interpret how they spin it. And, you know, even if they say it's not biased, you know, even the wording they use, sometimes it's more loaded wording that they use for things. And that's, I think, where the frustration lies with the media. And, you know, the Internet, I think you see more and more people doing that. And then, frankly, the fact remains that media, we all work busy hours, and you the Internet's more accessible on a regular basis with smartphones and things, where you're updated immediately versus waiting for the nightly news like it used to be an event, I think, 40 years ago.
Mike, thank you very much. You've given us a lot to talk about. Professor Ladd, want to pick and choose there?
Well, some really interesting ideas there. And one point he makes that I will agree with is that I don't want to say that we should go back to a media environment of the 50s and 60s and 70s, because it is a nice thing and a good thing when people have more choices, right? It's a good thing when people can, if they want to hear the news from someone who is interpreting it with more conservative values, they can find that. The news interpreting things from more liberal values, with more liberal values, they can find that. Rather, what I say in the book is that in that new environment, which is the environment we're in, and we're not going back, right? We're going to, in the future, we're likely to have all these options, more partisan options, as well as more conventional options of news that try to not be partisan. We're likely to have all these choices. We should try to, in that environment, not the old environment we had, but in this new environment, try to make sure people become informed about basic facts about the country so that they can evaluate politicians and reelect politicians when things are going well, and, you know, turn out politicians when things are going poorly. One important consequence I think the caller both points out and illustrates is some findings that a professor named Marcus Pryor at Princeton University documented a couple years ago, which is that one of the consequences of the more diverse media environment is that there are options for becoming really informed. If you want to be a political junkie, you can soak up political information on your smartphone, on the Internet, everywhere, like it sounds like the caller is. And if you want to tune out from politics, it's actually a lot easier to do that because we have, you know, ESPN and, you know, Bravo Network and the E! Entertainment Network and all these channels, right? It's also a lot easier to avoid the news. So what Marcus Pryor found is that one consequence of media choice is that some people get really, really well informed because they like politics, and people who aren't too interested in politics get actually less informed than they used to be. So it has these complicated consequences.
Thank you very much, Mike, for the call. Before news, we have time for Linda in Monroe. Hello, Linda.
Excuse me. Hello, Joy. I agree with your guest, Mr. Ladd. I think you've got a very timely program here because the caller you had on earlier this week when you interviewed Thomas Frank said that the problem was the media. Now, I believe the high point of the media was when the Washington Post caught President Nixon in a lie during the cover of the Watergate hearings, which forced his eventual resignation. Now, I believe the low point now is has come because of our deteriorating economy and how to solve our growing debt. Now, the solution being all cuts to programs or raising the income tax on the wealthy, which Grover Norquist is totally against. Now, a good example of this is when a politician was interviewed on the Sunday morning programs, and they asked him three times if he had signed Grover Norquist's pledge, and he didn't answer the question. So my question is, how can we solve any problem like the growing debt when Mr. Norquist says he'll go after anyone who breaks their promise?
Well, I'm not sure. Well, let me have our guest think about that. We'll talk more about the media angle of that than the Grover Norquist angle of that. But thank you very much, Linda, for the call. We are talking with the author of Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters, Jonathan Ladd, assistant professor of government and public policy at Georgetown University. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions. We're trying to figure out how the news media went from being one of the most respected institutions in the U.S. just a few decades ago to one of the most hated today, and what this means for our political system. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So do you trust the news media for political information? Why or why not? Is there a particular news anchor or outlet that you think is particularly trustworthy? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 7:36 on this Friday, February the 17th. We are talking with the author of the book, Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. Our guest is Jonathan Ladd, assistant professor of government and public policy at Georgetown University. In his book, he examines why the news media went from being one of the most respected institutions in the United States just a few decades ago to one of the most hated today, and how that's affecting how we get our political information and make our voting decisions. We heard from a caller just before news time, Professor Ladd, Linda von Monroe, who pointed out a high point and a low point as far as she was concerned with media, thinking that it was a real high point in 1972. She was talking about the coverage of Watergate. And was that, were we happy to see the reporters uncover all this information about former President Richard Nixon?
Well, all the evidence indicates people were very happy to see that. Not just did polls at the time indicate that reporters were very popular and after that occurred and Nixon became very unpopular, but of course in popular culture at the time, you know, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, who first uncovered Watergate for the Washington Post, you know, were heroically portrayed in a popular Hollywood movie by some of the most successful actors of the time, Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman, respectively, right? So what else can any of us ask for except to be played by charismatic movie stars?
Yeah, I'm thinking though that there might have been Nixon supporters who thought that Woodward and Bernstein were a couple of liberal hacks out to get the president.
That's true. The Republican supporters weren't very happy with the investigation of Watergate But at that time, people who disliked the press were really confined to, mm-hmm. you know, hardcore Republican supporters and about that issue, rather than it being more widespread. One thing in response to what the caller said is that was the high point of trust in the media.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really clear that this is the low point. So if you go prior to the 1950s, there's some evidence that the press was much less trusted. So, you know, if we go back to 1956, National Election Study, a large survey, found that 66% of people thought newspapers were fair. But if we pull back to the 1930s, so there's a 1938 Roper poll that also asks how many people thought newspapers were fair, and it was down to about 40% then. And there's a lot of reason to think that prior to the 30s, if we keep going back, newspapers continued to be not very well trusted. We don't have modern opinion polls before the 1930s. People didn't know how to do sample surveys, so we don't have actual polling data prior to that we can draw on. But if you look at the popular culture, what people were saying, what everyone was saying, how the press was discussed in the 1890s and throughout the whole 1800s, as well as the early 20th century, the press does not seem to be very well respected at all.
Mm-hmm.
People refer to journalists was not a high-status profession. It was considered more of a blue-collar profession, popular culture doesn't depict it very positively, and there's all circumstantial evidence indicates that journalists as a whole weren't very well trusted.
So
of partisan press, as well as yellow journalism of Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst in the late 1800s, and the press wasn't held in very high esteem.
So, yay, we're not at the low point. but
yeah.
She did mention that she thought, anyway, in her lifetime, a low point is seeing a congressperson on one of the Sunday shows being asked three different times if he signed a no tax increase pledge, and I guess not answering it. And not going into Grover Norquist's influence on politics, but on the media aspect of that question, are we not, as a group, journalists doing a good enough job holding our politicians' feet to the fire?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I'm a little skeptical that journalists are less good at getting politicians to give straight answers than they once were. My perspective would be politicians are politicians that have been, you know, in democracies from the beginning of time, right? And they're always going to want to answer questions in ways that are favorable to them, and always going to want to, you know, try to become more popular by maybe answering not the question that was asked, but the question they wish was asked, you know, and try to, I'm not going to say lie, but try to twist the truth in ways that are favorable. I mean, you have to accept that that's probably a universal aspect of politics and having politicians and being in a democracy. It's not really, and I don't think any journalists maybe have magical powers to force politicians, to be honest. What probably is different is that when politicians aren't perhaps forthcoming, there's no one source in the country that everyone trusts to tell them what the actual truth is. So when politicians don't give clear answers, fewer of the public is all agreeing that they could maybe rely on the network news to tell them, well, what is this politician's true position or what is this? Instead, people go to different sources. And some tell them that the politician's true position is this. If it's a Democratic-leaning source, some tell them that the politician's true position is the other way, if it's a Republican-leaning source. And some people will never know because they're going to tune into ESPN instead and say, I'm not too interested in this. I'm not going to bother finding out what the politician's real position is. All right? So that's what ends up happening now.
Let's take another call from Daryl in Exonia. Hi, Daryl. You're on the air.
Hi. I would just like to say, like, on last night's news on ABC, NBC, and CBS all had the same stories. They opened with the same story, which was General Motors made money. They're talking about arsenic and brown rice. This is supposed to be the world news. Who decides this is the number one story in the world? This is world news. And I'd like to address, you know, you say the part of your show is why it matters. And, you know, there was an article in Harper's a while back, and it talked about, like, this bomb hit a house. One of our drones hit a missile next to this house of innocent family. They're laying there. This guy, the father had like shrapnel hanging out of his belly. The daughter had her legs blown off. The mother was killed. They sat there for like 12 hours before anybody came and helped them. Those are the kind of news stories that we don't hear that would maybe shape public opinion saying, hey, maybe it's not such a good idea to just be dropping missiles indiscriminately on people because we think there might be a bad guy down there.
All right. We get you, Daryl. So who decides that the GM story is the most important story in the world on all three of these networks? He says it was the lead story. And that I think that's why he thinks it's not.
Yeah,
he
it's an important question. Mm-hmm. Why do some news stories get covered more than others?
Mm-hmm.
So one aspect of it that I think is true now, has been true for a long time, is that in journalism, oftentimes one story gets covered because there are few leaders nationally that other journalists tend to follow. So if a few things are covered, there's some famous studies done in the 70s and 80s of this, and I think the phenomenon is still true, that if something is covered a lot by the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or other big sort of news industry leaders, it can be covered by a lot of other sources. Also, network news follow each other, and they see, if CBS says, if NBC is covering this, maybe I should be covering it too. So they watch each other, and there's a bit of a pack mentality. And so this happens. One other thing that influences what gets covered in the U.S. versus some areas overseas. I mean, you see sometimes examples of Time magazine covers,
yes,
and how they differ overseas than domestically. John Stewart on his show did a segment on this earlier this week.
Yeah, there'll be something very very important, or some story about war or terrorism on the overseas editions, and we'll have some popular culture story on the American edition.
Yeah, and what I tend to see as a big thing that's driving that is that it depends what sort of market Time is trying to go for overseas and what market they're trying to go for here. So there is a market for serious foreign policy news, but it's sort of limited, right? There are some people who want to read that every week, and there are a lot of people who don't. And in this choice media environment, we aren't able to force anyone to buy a magazine they're not interested in, or listen to a radio report or watch television they're not interested in. So, what I suspect is that overseas, these news magazines have decided that they are going to target and cater toward the market that is interested in this, and not try and say that that's going to be our market. And that's going to be our readership, and we're not going to try for a bigger readership, which is a legitimate business strategy, right? And in the U.S., they appear to be trying saying this market, this small, limited market, but potentially profitable market of just people who are interested in serious foreign policy news isn't enough. Instead, we don't want to go for that market. We want to attempt to go for the somewhat bigger market of people who are interested in these lifestyle stories, these human interest stories, and that's the covers we tend to get of Time magazine. And that's a choice they make, and I'm not sure if they're being that successful in getting that sort of wider, somewhat bigger lifestyle market. But they could go for this smaller but still potentially viable, serious news market. There are a few people who want to read that, but there are a number of people who do, but they've chosen not to.
So, Professor Ladd, are people today, for the most part, if they're politically involved, are they just looking for, finding, watching, reading news outlets that they agree with? The partisan media and ignoring what they consider the other side?
Not everyone, but a good portion of people are, and more than they used to. I put some of evidence of this in my book. There's also been some great research on this by a professor named Talia Stroud at the University of Texas at Austin, and she has a book on this as well, that you do find
compared to earlier eras, much more of this partisan self-selection of people tuning in to cable news outlets that agree with them. So Democrats tuning in to MSNBC more than other cable channels, Republicans turning into Fox News more than other cable channels, and self-selection on radio sort of political talk shows, as well as internet websites. Now, some of this is not as much as people think, in that 100% of a conservative cable channel or a liberal conservative channel audience are not people who agree with them. You know, it's more like 60 or 70%. But there is a lot of self-selection. And some people are very concerned about it. I'm less concerned than some. I mean, Kate Sunstein, who is a law professor at Harvard and has served a position in the Obama administration, wrote a book called Republic.com, where his main, which is fairly widely read, and which his main point was that you can't have a democracy if people don't have a common set of facts and everyone's tuning in just to sources that agree with them. You know, I think I'm less concerned, less alarmed than Kay Sunstein is. I think my take is that people have a right to their choices, and we shouldn't really force people to listen to things they don't want to listen to, read things they don't want to listen to. The only thing is we should try to ameliorate the worst symptom of this. And the worst symptom is if the public doesn't have sort of accurate information with which to reward and punish incumbents, right? And put politicians, presidents, senators, members of Congress back in power when they produce good results for the country and out of power when they produce bad results. If people don't have accurate facts to do that, then that's a problem. We should think about ways to make sure that people still are able to reward and punish politicians based on some common set of facts.
Our guest is Jonathan Ladd. He is author of Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. We'll get to more of your calls after this quick check of the weather. Turning mostly cloudy today with a chance of snow in the north and a chance of rain in the south. Highs today, upper 30s to low 40s. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. It's the Week in Review coming up after 8 o'clock. To more of your calls now for Jonathan Ladd, Assistant Professor of Government and Public Policy at Georgetown University and author of Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. Rick in Milwaukee is next. Hello, Rick.
Hi. I've been forced to revise my comments because I don't think I'll have much time here. I believe the greatest journalist in American history was H.L. Mencken, a man who never spent a day in a college or university, but simply had a nose for news and followed stories wherever they led, regardless of what politicians, what political parties, what ideologies, what belief systems, or what groups of business people might be offended. He just didn't give a damn about that kind of stuff. But now we got our universities since the 60s have become primarily political institutions where they manufacture their own sets of facts to agree with their belief systems, and that's where our so-called journalists are trained. So you get these people who are essentially elitists who, if you can get them to cover a story, it's always through some sort of political filter. You know, that's what political correctness is all about. That's what that word means.
All right. Thank you, Rick. What about that? Professor Ladd.
Well, the caller's correct that the education level of people going into journalism increased a lot from the 1800s to the 1900s. Most people in the 1800s, most journalists in the 1800s, we like to say it was considered a blue-collar profession. Most didn't graduate from college. Many journalists would work their way up through the newspaper. It would be not uncommon to start as a typesetter or someone who worked repairing the printing press as your starting job and work your way up to actually writing for the newspaper, because it was sort of a blue-collar profession. And by the 20th century, it had become a profession where most people went to college, which a lot of that was influenced actually by Joseph Pulitzer, who in his will, gave most of his fortune to Columbia to start the Columbia School of Journalism. In the 19-teens,
and schools of journalism just came into existence in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s. So demographics of journalism changed a lot. H.L. Mencken is a great example of the very diverse media landscape of the 1800s. In the 1800s, you had a great number of newspapers, far more newspapers than we have now, and some that were partisan, some that were not, some that were idiosyncratic, some reporters that were idiosyncratic, like Mencken, some reporters with no interest in politics, but, you know, covering sensationalist crime stories, that sort of thing. That's the thing you commonly had in Pulitzer and Hearst papers. So great example of the colorful, sort of diverse journalism and of the 1800s.
We are almost out of time, but I meant to talk to you about how the media are becoming the story on the presidential campaign trail in many ways, with Newt Gingrich going after moderators of the debates for asking, you know, stupid questions and being members of the elite media. Let's take a listen to Dick Morris, former Clinton advisor. Now, I think he's a Fox News commentator. Dick Morris talking to Sean Hannity on Fox News.
The first piece of evidence was after Santorum won Iowa. The first controversy was, do you think states should have the right to ban contraception? Where did that come from? Then you remember that ABC debate with that paid Democratic hitman, George Stephanopoulos, went after Romney trying to pin him down on contraception. And Romney kept saying, George, nobody wants to make contraception. No, but do they have the theoretical power to do it? Remember, it was 5 minutes. People were laughing at him, booing him. Well, that
was... He was doing this on direct
under orders.
Yeah, so here we're being told that that the media are in bed with the Obama administration or the Democratic Party to bring down Republicans.
Well, yeah. So a couple of things that are interesting about that clip. You know, one is you see this phenomenon which is very widespread, which is that coverage on a more partisan outlet, that being Fox News. A lot of that coverage is devoted to criticizing the coverage of other news outlets and trying to discredit other news outlets among their viewership. So in this case, it's Fox News and their commentators, right, trying to discredit ABC News and CNN and other news organizations that are hosting debates. And that's something you see fairly commonly. Another thing you see is that... one of the things they were describing was when Newt Gingrich and others would criticize the press during the debates. And one consequence of the press being so unpopular is that attacking the press is a very effective strategy for Republican candidates for president to use. Newt Gingrich criticized the press during the debate or attacked the moderator very frequently. And usually his poll numbers went up after debates where he was particularly aggressive in criticizing the moderators, not other candidates. And that's because among everyone, the press is unpopular among Republicans, even less popular than Democrats, and among hardcore Republicans who tend to vote in primaries, even less popular than that. So that's one consequence of the world we live in.
We have just a minute to go. Do you see the our trust in the media changing anytime soon?
No, I don't. I think the big question is whether trust in the media will go down further and ratings for conventional news organizations will go down further. Ratings for network news and conventional newspapers have gone down a lot. The only sort of conventional news organization that hasn't been has kept its ratings and actually gone up is actually National Public Radio. So the question is, going into the future, will conventional sources of news trying to follow more conventional style continue to exist and continue to compete against more partisan and more sensationalist sources? And I think they will. I think they're all going to exist in the future.
Thank you very much for being with us, Jonathan Ladd, author of Why Americans Hate the Media.